Lecture 8, Book 4, Justice in the City and Seoul.
We've reached Book 4 of Plato's Republic. Perhaps you remember that in Lecture 1, I described the Republic as being very clearly structured. It has four distinct parts. Book 1 of the Republic is a prologue, and then there are three sections of roughly equal length, books 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and the last part, books 8, 9, and 10. Having reached Book 4, we're reaching the end of this major stage in the Republic. And Socrates says as much when he says to Glaucon and Adeimantus, his two main speaking partners, that he has completed his construction of the city. You recall that at the beginning of Book 2, he embarked on this project to construct a city, and now he claims he has done his job, he has finished the city. To review its essential features, it's a tripartite city, meaning it has three distinct classes, gold, silver, bronze, rulers, helpers, workers. It's a city in which the guardians, the rulers, have no private property, they have no family. It's a city in which education is paramount, education of a peculiarly Socratic sort. Socrates then says, look, if the city has been correctly constructed, as he believes it has, then it should be perfectly good. And if it's perfectly good, it should have four qualities. And these qualities are, and I'm referring now to line 427e, the city should be wise, it should be courageous, it should be moderate, and of course, it should be just. Now, where did Socrates get these four qualities, these four virtues? He got them from traditional Greek thought. These four virtues, wisdom, courage, moderation, and justice, are long considered to be, in ancient Greece, the four cardinal virtues. Now, why is the city counted to be wise? It's wise because it's ruled by the guardian's skill, the guardian's knowledge. 428d. Why is the city counted to be courageous? It's courageous because its soldiers will endure any danger in order to follow the orders given to them by their rulers. They will not flinch. I'm referring here to lines 430a to c. The city is moderate. Another translation of this Greek word would be self-controlled or temperate. The city is moderate because all citizens in it are able to restrain their desires, control themselves. And they do this in order to follow the orders of their leaders. Why, finally, and most importantly, is the city just? The city is just, and I'm quoting from 433b, because each of the citizens, quote, minds his own business. It's a very, perhaps, strange phrase, minds his own business. That's the translation that I use, the translation by Alan Bloom. You may have a slightly different translation. What the Greek literally says is that each of the citizens does the things that belong to him. That's as literal as I can make the translation. A more revealing way to put it would be to say that what justice is each of the citizens doing their own thing, each of the citizens doing their own job, the work, the job, the task, the thing that is appropriate for them. Finally, it seems we have found the answer to the question that started Plato's Republic. The question that was asked as early as Book 1. which is, what is justice? We now have an official definition at 433b, minding his own business. Might be puzzling to you why that seemingly innocuous phrase could count as the definition of a virtue as lofty as justice. And we will concentrate on that in just a few minutes. In fact, justice conceived as minding your own business has been implicit in the city as a principle since the very beginning. And perhaps you recall what the very beginning of the city was. We saw it in Book 2. The city began in the needs that each of us has for another. This was what I called the original city. The city that was very simple, that met only the minimal basic needs that human beings have. It was a city that was organized around a scheme, a principle of the division of labor. We had a farmer. The farmer grows crops, shares the crops with the others. We have a builder. He builds houses. The other people live in the houses. The farmer doesn't build houses. The builder doesn't grow crops. Each individual in the city has his own job. Each individual in the city does his own thing. Socrates says at lines 433a that the way that this system works best is if each citizen practices that one job, that one function in the city for which he is naturally suited. And again, I hope you recall that I made this point several lectures ago. We don't want, for example, a man with very large and clumsy hands to be a shoemaker, because that particular craft requires finesse. And we can't allow someone with very small hands to be a builder, because that job requires great manual strength. So each person in the city should do the one job for which they are naturally suited. To put this point in terms that we developed from the Noble Lie, the first part and the second part of the Noble Lie, gold-souled citizens who, like every other citizen, are born from the earth, must be the guardians because they are gold-souled. They are the best. They are naturally fitted to rule. Silver-souled citizens are second best. Socrates will sometimes call these people the auxiliaries, the helpers. They have some spirit, they have some energy, they have some intelligence, not as much as gold-souled people. Their job is to be assistants to the rulers. Their job, perhaps most importantly, will be to be soldiers, to obey orders, to go into battle and do what they're told. The third category of citizen, born from the earth like all citizens, are the bronze-souled citizens. They are workers, and their function is simply to obey orders. Whether they are farmers or builders or shoemakers, they're just going to receive orders and obey them. So what, on a political scale, is justice? Justice is the harmonious working of each of the three classes in the city. Above all else, this just city that Socrates, as he believes, has now completed in Book 4, suffers no factionalism. There's no tension between the classes. Above all else, there is no rebellion. There's no civil war. Plato undoubtedly was haunted by memories of the late 5th century in ancient Greece, where there was so much trouble. And he is creating a system in his imagination, in which there would be no such civil strife. To explain and to elaborate on these ideas, Socrates returns us to the city-soul analogy, which comes from Book 2. And perhaps you remember it. The notion here is that the city and the soul are isomorphic. They have the same structure. Socrates illustrates this with the example of letters. If I have a very, very small letter at the bottom of an eye chart, and then a larger version of the same letter at the top of the eye chart, I can see the larger easily. And then if I know that the two letters have the same structure, I know what the letter at the bottom of the eye chart is. He suggests that's the relationship between city and soul. The city, he says, is the soul written large. It's like a blown up version of an individual soul. The city is tripartite. It has three classes, gold, silver, bronze. Therefore, given the city-soul analogy, the soul, the psyche, must have three parts. And now we are embarked on what's known by scholars as Plato's tripartite psychology. The word psychology, as I've said several times, is derived from the Greek word psyche or psuche, and that is often translated as soul. According to Socrates, the individual soul has three parts. They are reason, spirit, and desire. You can refer to lines 436a. Clearly, the analogy is reason is just like the gold-souled people, spirit, the silver-souled, the auxiliaries, desire, the bronze. Socrates is anticipating someone being perplexed by this notion of the individual psyche having three parts. So he wants to defend his idea, and he gives an argument. And this argument runs from 436b to 439d. And I'll paraphrase it. He gives this hypothetical situation. Imagine you are very thirsty, but your doctor has told you, because you're ill, that you shouldn't drink. Well, what seems to be happening, if I were to put a glass of water in front of you, is that you both want to drink because you're thirsty, and you don't want to drink. You're attracted to the water, and you're repelled by the water. What Socrates insists is that that description of what is happening can't be right. It can't be the case, says Socrates, that you both want and do not want the water. Why not? That would be a contradiction. And Socrates is a great lover of rationalism. He's a logical man. He doesn't like contradictions. So that description of you facing the water, you want the water and you do not want the water, can't be right. So what must be happening, he concludes, is that there really are two parts inside of you. One part of you does want the water, and that's your desire. You're thirsty. But another part of you is restraining you from accepting the water, and that's your reason. With that argument, he believes he has established two of the three parts in the soul, reason and desire. They're different in exactly, or I should say, analogous to the gold and the bronze classes of citizens in this tripartite city. What about the third part of the soul, which was identified as spirit? That, again, almost mysterious quality of human beings that they have, which allows them to compete with such vigor, which turns them into aggressive, victory-loving people. How does Socrates demonstrate that that's a separate part of the human soul? I'm referring now to 439e to 440b. Interestingly, he doesn't give an argument for this. He did give an argument to establish the difference between reason and desire. When it comes to spirit, instead, he tells a story. He tells the story of a man named Leontius, a rather strange story. Plato tells many such strange stories. One day, Leontius was walking around town, and he just happened to pass by the place where criminals are executed. And as a result, there were dead bodies in that place. Now, he was very desirous of seeing those dead bodies. He was curious, perhaps. And so he was attracted to those dead bodies. But he believed, and this would be his reason speaking to him, he believed that was a terrible thing to want to see. But he couldn't restrain himself. He looked at those dead bodies, and then he got angry at himself, and he cursed his own eyes. That's a very interesting and actually very familiar experience that I think people have had. That moment at which we get angry at ourselves and even curse ourselves. And that sort of story, says Socrates, illustrates the middle part of the soul, that part known as spirit. At this point then, Socrates has completed the city-soul analogy. Tripartite city, tripartite soul. The notion from the beginning of this passage was that the city is perfectly just, and therefore the individual must be perfectly just. We have been looking since the beginning of the Republic for this individual sense of justice. This tripartite psychology that Socrates has just developed allows him to explain what it is. And I'll be discussing 441D to 444A. The perfectly good individual, like the perfectly good city, is wise, courageous, moderate, and just, the four cardinal virtues. He is wise because reason rules him. He is courageous because his spirit, that capacity for anger experienced, for example, by Leontius, his spirit is the loyal ally of his reason. Spirit is working together with reason in order to restrain or moderate the third part of the soul, desire. Desires obey the dictates of reason. Reason orders spirit to assist it in the subordination of desire. This individual can now be called just because each part of his soul minds his own business. Same phrase. Does the appropriate work that is assigned to it. The job of reason is to give orders. The job of desire is to obey orders. The job of spirit is to assist reason as it gives orders and make sure that desires obey. Let me give you a direct quotation from 443D. Socrates says the following. The just man, I quote, arranges himself, becomes his own friend, and harmonizes the three parts exactly like three notes in a harmonic scale. It's a very telling line. Returns us to the discussion of music. Music in that narrow sense that we use the word that's very prominent earlier in the Republic. Justice is a kind of harmony where each of the individual parts works together for the well-being of the whole. This is true on the level of the individual. This is true on the level of the city. What then is injustice? Injustice, 444B, is factionalism. Injustice is disharmony. If desire should happen to take control of an individual, that's a disharmonious individual. That's an unjust individual. If the bronze-souled people in the city try to run the city or try to wrest control of the city away from the gold-souled people, we have civil strife, we have disharmony, we have injustice. Another way Socrates puts this point is to describe justice, I'm going to refer to 444E, as a certain kind of health of both city and soul. Health. Health and harmony are the two great metaphors that Socrates uses to describe justice. And especially health, I think, is very useful in reminding us of the second great question with which we began. The first was, what is justice? We've answered that question in Book 4. At least Socrates believes we have. Justice is each of the parts of city and soul minding their own business. But the second great question, the question that was behind Glaucon's story of the Ring of Gyges. You recall that story of a man who had a ring which made him invisible. The question that story provokes is, why should we be just? If we could get away with it, why not be unjust? Why is justice intrinsically more valuable than injustice? And now we have an answer. Because justice is like health, and health is better than disease. Health is a good in and of itself. You recall at the beginning of Book 2, Glaucon divides good things into three categories. There are those good things that are good in themselves, there are those good things that are good only for their consequences, and there are those good things like health, which are good both in themselves and for their consequences. We've now discovered that justice is like health. It's the harmonious, healthy functioning of an individual human being and of a city. And therefore, it's met the test. It's answered Glaucon's challenge. So at least Socrates believes. Let me turn next to some thoughts about the city-soul analogy. As always, I urge you to be critical of Socrates and to think critically about everything you read in the Republic. I do so again. It seems to me that the city-soul analogy could be conceived of as quite problematic. In your bibliography, you'll see an article listed by a great British philosopher named Bernard Williams. He was a 20th century philosopher, and he offered a very, very powerful critique of the entire city-soul analogy. And everything, virtually, that we've discussed in the Republic so far has been dependent on the city-soul analogy. And let me briefly summarize Williams' critique of the city-soul analogy, and ask you to do the same. Recall, the city-soul analogy implies that there is a tripartite structure on each side. The city has three parts, the individual soul has three parts. When it comes to the city, Williams says, this is just false. This can't be true. Not only is it false, it's also incoherent. This is false because the city-soul analogy on the side of the city implies that there would be a class of citizens, these bronze-souled people, who are completely bereft of reason. You remember the structure: gold, reason; silver, spirit; bronze, desire. Well, these three parts are separated from each other. How, Williams asks, could there be a human being who doesn't have reason? Would a human being without reason even be human? No. That's Williams' answer. Even if it were possible remotely to conceive as some human beings as being irrational, it would be incoherent still to postulate the city-soul analogy on the side of the city. Now, why is that? Because who are these bronze-souled people? They are the people who receive orders from the gold-souled people, the rulers, the guardians. But in order to receive an order, you must be rational. I can't order a turtle to do something. I can make a turtle do something by physically forcing it to, but I can't issue a command and expect a turtle to obey me. Why? A turtle seems to be irrational. If these bronze-souled people are so irrational, how will they follow orders? Hence, Williams concludes that the tripartite division, the city-soul analogy, is fatally flawed. The same problem would infect the city-soul analogy on the side of the individual. Because inside each individual, as we just discussed, there are three parts. One of those parts is desire. Well, this same problem emerges right away. How can reason, the first and presumably best part of a human being, how can reason order around desire if desire is not the least bit rational? How could desire accept the commands? There's a problem when it comes to reason as well. Reason, because it's so separated from desire, has no real impetus to give commands. When I give a command to you, I do so because I want you to accomplish something for me. If I had no desires, how could I issue a command? It's desire that's the impetus in human activity. But reason on the tripartite model is bereft of desire. Hence, it has no impetus. Again, William makes this a criticism of the city-soul analogy and the general tripartite scheme. I think William's critique is very powerful. Nonetheless, I would urge you to think somewhat more sympathetically about the tripartite psychology and the tripartite division in the city. And let me express this in rather casual terms, not formal argumentative terms. Isn't it true that you have behaved just like Leontius? Didn't you ever get really mad at yourself because, for example, you ate a third piece of chocolate cake when you knew it was bad for you? Isn't that exactly the way you would describe the experience? And don't you yell at yourself afterwards? But even think about that very ordinary phrase, I got mad at myself. That very phrase suggests that we do, in fact, divide ourselves up. I, my reason, got mad, my spirit, at myself, my desires. Leontius curses his eyes. After you eat that third piece of chocolate cake, you might curse your eyes. Again, that's a very casual way to put the point. I'm not sure by itself it surmounts the objections of Bernard Williams. However, I think it lends some credence to the tripartite psychology. Let me now do the same exercise when it comes to the city. The city has three parts. One part is gold, one part is bronze. It's a very disturbing image. It suggests that there's a class of citizens that only obeys orders and is virtually bereft of reason. As usual, now in our study of the Republic, you may have been made uncomfortable by this. Nonetheless, I urge you to try to think about it a little bit sympathetically again. And here's the reason why. Isn't it true that we would very much welcome a ruler who has knowledge? That is exactly what's postulated by the tripartite political system. One of the most disturbing things about politics, and particularly democratic politics, the politics of America, the politics of ancient Athens, is that rulers are chosen by the majority. The key to political success in a democracy is to win over the population. There is no knowledge requirement put on a successful politician in a democracy. What democracy, therefore, is, and this is a foreshadowing of Socrates' very explicit criticism of democracy, which will occur much later in the Republic, democracy is rule by opinion, not by knowledge. What I think is accomplished by the division of the city into three parts is a reminder of how greatly we would, in fact, welcome rule by knowledge. With this, Socrates has, he believes, fulfilled his task of explaining what justice is and why it's preferable for both city and individual. He's next prepared to move to the next stage of the analysis, which is a discussion of unjust regimes. But before he gets to do that, he is interrupted, and that will take us to the beginning of Book 5.